Hello, hello. Welcome to Series 2 of Tell Them, a podcast hosted by Tamasha in partnership with Transmission Roundhouse.
My name is Tue and I am the digital producer for Tamasha.
My name is Samia and I am one of the producers of Tamasha.
You can't see Samia right now, but I can and she is glowing.
I'm not pregnant.
No, she's just been sweating on the tube to get here.
It's just called sweat. It's actually called setting spray.
Yeah,
I'm not going to put the brand in because I don't think we're allowed.
No,
but
I don't think we're allowed. I don't even
I'm going to gatekeep that one.
And last week we had Toby Cherimatang chatting to Amara Spence and Inua Ellams in all things permanent black spaces in the arts. If you haven't had the chance to tune in, go on our socials or go over to Transmission Roundhouse platforms and have a listen.
Reach out to them. Reach out to them.
Let me introduce our guest presenter for this episode. I'm really excited to have May Mack with us here today. And she really is an incredible human who does a bit of everything.
May Mack, she, her, is an actor, theatre maker, puppeteer, mover and activist. She has also worked as a movement director, associate director, dramaturg, facilitator and is newly making her name as a panel chair.
She is a founder of Rising Waves, a mentorship program for EC artists. EC is East Southeast Asian, connecting emerging artists with established artists. Their motto is Together We Rise and aim to uplift the community by nurturing the culture of skill sharing and empowering and celebrating each other.
She is also an associate artist of New Earth Theatre, Whole Hog Theatre and is mentored by Rash Dash. She has also previously been working and lobbying with Public Campaign for the Arts.
Hey, mate.
Hey.
What's that? Hey, May. Don't know where that came from. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm sweltering in this heat.
I know. I guess like when people are listening to it, it'd probably be a much cooler period.
Oh, yeah. I mean, maybe we can bring the sun into that autumn month now. Mm. Just imagine that you're lying in that hot London air.
Mm. That doesn't sound good. Mm. I'm just like imagining myself behind a bus on a bike, just like struggling to breathe.
Listen, when you're freezing your ass off on the tube, you will appreciate this.
I am really excited to have you here and even more excited about the guests that are going to discuss our episode today. So I feel like I don't need to talk anymore. So I'm going to say, May, take the mic and let's excite our listeners with our guest speakers.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Dewey. This is so exciting for me to be joining this podcast. And it's my absolute honour to be invited on. So thank you so much. I'm so excited to introduce our two guests today. But actually, I'd love for you to introduce yourselves. Put you on the spot. Frey, would you mind introducing yourself?
Sure. Hi, my name's Frey. I am a critic and a dramaturg and I live and work in London. I review for The Stage, What's on Stage, Exeunt magazine. I've worked with theatres and companies like The Bush and The Young Vic and others, which I can't remember now because May has put us on the spot. And I like theatre that scares me and things that shake me in terms of my ideas and in terms of forms. And I strongly believe all cops are bastards. I think that'll do. I also am a script reader for a free script reading service called Free Hand, which anyone looking for dramaturgical support should reach out to.
And Shiva, would you mind introducing yourself?
Hello, everyone. My name is Shiva Raichandani. I am a multidisciplinary non-binary artist. A lot of my work tends to challenge heteronormativity and center queerness, center transness, non-binary identities. My mediums are film, TV, and dance. I'm a writer, director, and producer. I also am a professional dance educator and performer. And I also work within diversity, equity, and inclusion consulting within sort of the wider creative industries. So yeah, I think that sort of sums it up.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. So we get to talk about two very exciting titles today. And I'm really excited to have both a maker and a reviewer in the room because I think that is a really gorgeous combination of how we put work out there, but also how we spread the word about the great work. And the two titles that we get to talk about today is the Bitten Peach documentary Peach Paradise and Queer Parivar, which has just done the rounds at the BFI and all around globally. It is such a joy to see queer Asian work that centres joy, honestly, as an act of resistance. And I truly believe that that's the most powerful thing that we can do to resist, is to lean into our joy and to be moving away from using trauma as the only way of seeing our narrative and the only version of our story. And I just wanted to hear about how that was, to be able to make work that is so centered in joy.
I think it was important for me to tap into happiness and hope, especially because I feel like I didn't see that as a possibility for me growing up, given the kind of depictions that we had or the representation that we had of queer South Asians. Not that there were many, and those that were out there, they were almost sidelined, they were caricatures, they were always villainized, or they came from a point of sadness, trauma, violence, death, murder, and all of these negative sort of realms of storytelling. And so I never saw myself, A, within those storylines and narratives, but also B, thriving and potentially finding, having dreams, having hopes, or having that sort of vision of a life that could be. And so with these films, what was important to me, and the beauty about the two films is because one is a documentary and one is a scripted film. So the documentary, what we got to do was actually document queer lives as they are right now. People who are out there living their lives, being successful, leveraging all of their intersectional identities to put themselves out there, put their work out there, even if that means at a cost to themselves, at a risk, but they're still doing it. And so to learn from them through this project was beautiful. And the Bit and Peach are an incredible collective with a myriad of experiences. And Sheshe is a phenomenal human being on and off stage. And to have been on that journey with them, I think for me, it was transcendent. And to tap into the ways in which they find joy as a family, as that chosen family, as a community, and then to take all of that on a stage and share it with audiences in masses, to see that was beautiful. And with Queer Parivar, to then create something that I felt I wanted to see in terms of scripting something and bringing people that I looked up to, that I loved, to come being part of that process as well, that was beautiful. And to tell a story that was very personal, that didn't discount, obviously, the kinds of traumas that we do have and the kinds of challenges that queer people are uniquely faced with, but to not lose sight of joy and celebration, because I feel like we need more room for that.
Yeah, it's glorious, the description of chosen family that exists in both the pieces. So for our viewers and our listeners, apologies, who haven't seen both shows, I highly recommend checking them out. So Peach Paradise is a documentary following Bitten Peach and its founder Sheshe, a non-binary Japanese Irish drag artist who is storming the UK's cabaret scene with a gender diverse pan-Asian collective to dismantle racial stereotypes with love and glitter. And you can check that out on YouTube. And Queer Parivar is a short musical film based on a queer South Asian romance, which is currently doing the rounds and had its premiere at the BFI, which is extraordinarily exciting. And Frey, I would love to get your thoughts on having experienced both these pieces and how they were for you, both as a reviewer, but also as a maker yourself and a dramaturg.
Yeah, I really enjoyed, especially the way that you capture movement and movement and dance and music in both pieces. I think that's something which feels unified across them. The colour jumps out so much. The people in both are very beautiful, as we were discussing before you arrived. And we were talking about just how queer people just, you know,
are stunning.
Gorgeous. We just look better, you know.
But unfortunately, we're not showcasing that vibrance and that beauty. So,
Yeah. And so it was a delight to see the actors and the subjects of your documentary, you know, shining out in that way. I think that what I was interested in both a quality that you seem to have as a filmmaker is the use of when you use sound and when you use silence in both. I found that really interesting because there were times in Queer Parivar that I found myself wanting to get closer to the characters and to at times hear what they were saying when you made the choice to take the sound away. And it made me think about questions of how how far we were allowed to know these characters, what their functions were within the film that you decided on.
That is such an interesting observation as well, that I don't think anyone's pointed out. But yes, there were like some very serious active choices with where to bring in sound, where to encapsulate storylines just through music, which I think is also a very common practice in mainstream Hindi cinema, Bollywood cinema, where they use music and dance to tell a story. So a lot can happen within just one song without telling the audiences, like sort of allowing, inviting them into sort of the nitty gritty dialogues, if you will, or the interactions, but you kind of get a sense of what's happening based on how that montage is created, if you will. So there were moments, for example, like a flashback scene in Queer Parivar when we see two people in love and one of them being trans, sort of grappling with the day-to-day challenges of gender dysphoria, but then finding comfort and love with their partner. So there were that intimate moments where we could have very easily gone into sort of listening in into conversations of that, but it felt nice to be sort of like this outsider eavesdropping in, or sort of like seeing it from the outside and experiencing their life through music rather than going into the sounds of conversation. And similarly with the wedding scene at the end, the entire thing is done in 6 minutes of music. There's literally no dialogue, and throughout that you get there's so much happening. It's the ceremony, the vows, the speeches, and then there's dancing, and there's so much going on, but it's all through music. So I thought that was a very active choice, but simultaneously there's a very elongated dialogue scene in between just two characters, a grandma and their grandchild, literally just on a sofa having a conversation, and we amplified that. And the reason being is sometimes we don't get to have those kinds of conversations as queer people, especially when we bring intergenerational narratives where two people of two different generations, both being queer, having very different experiences but finding common ground and sharing their experiences in that sense in a very gentle, intimate, calm way is something that we aren't afforded much of. And so we got a lot of like a lot of people were like, oh, that's too big a risk to take, like such a big long scene of just dialogue between just two people and everything else is just music. And I was like, yeah, but that's important in that sense, and to sit with it and to force people to sit with it and just experience that moment, no matter what the feeling comes out of it, whether it's discomfort or comfort. It's just so thank you. It's just a very interesting observation of sound, I guess. And because music plays such an important part in both films, yeah, because a lot of people talk about obviously the original soundtrack that comes with the film, but no one really has pinpointed the use of it in that sense. Thank you for that.
I think also in theatre as well, though, and, and Frey and I think we've probably spoken about this before, that the use of silence is music and sound within itself. The absence of sound
that's
is
part of design,
incredibly so. And and especially talking about queer narratives, our being used to sitting in uncomfortable situations and how the absence of sound causes the feeling of being uncomfortable. It's just a very interesting parallel to draw.
On a flip side, so in Peach Paradise, when you see the last, like literally the last few minutes, it's just Shay on stage to beautiful music. The initial draft that we had a voiceover of Shay speaking and sort of giving this send-off message as the end of the documentary. But in the last minute, I took that off because I felt like so much has already happened in the documentary. I don't need, this is a moment for Shay, and this is for a moment for us to just revel in their glory in the absence of anything being spoken. And so that also was a choice in terms of like, let the music do the talking in that sense and let Shay just be. So so I think there are very active choices in where to bring in music and not, and where to bring silence as well. So yeah, thank you for that.
No worries.
There's something really powerful I can't let go after saying the power in just being. And obviously we are used to, as people who live in marginalised communities, our existence being political. Just purely existing is political. And actually, it can be exhausting to exist in a political environment constantly. And so the freedom of just existing and that being a place of such pure beauty is really something to marvel in. And actually, that moment that ordinarily is uncomfortable when you take sound out of theatre, that is a moment of feeling uncomfortable, in those moments, there is so much comfort. And the subversion of that is really powerful. And I think I'm excited to see more of that subversion happening, both artistically and politically. Mm. I think that is a really lovely door that's opening, that I'm seeing a lot more art coming out of our communities these days. Yeah. But let's come back to talking about doing the rounds.
Yes,
and how
sorry.
Exciting that is.
I'm so bad at like promoting the film or talking about it in that sense. But
this is the opportunity.
So, Queer Parivar, we were very lucky to have our world premiere at the BFI Flare Festival, which is the UK's sort of like premier LGBT plus film festival. And it premiered also in the US at Outfest, which is, again, one of the most frontier LGBT plus film festivals. More recently, it was at Kashish Mumbai Film Festival, which is, again, Asia's sort of like reputed LGBT plus film festival. So it's going... I'm very excited... I'm very biased in the sense I'm more excited for it to go there, into Asia, into more Asian countries, and for Asians. Obviously, it was very beautiful to sit and watch it with a UK audience, with a US audience. But having sat with the audience in India and experiencing it with them, where I think they're more vocal with their expressions. So all their people were like hooting and whistling and screaming and laughing and giggling.
Yes.
And to be part of that sort of feedback, like live feedback of people, was such a joy, because obviously to them, they get the nuances. They get the things that you don't need to explain, and things that are just part of their day-to-day culture that would probably only be visible to them in that sense. So that's exciting. The movie's headed to so many different places, going to Taiwan, it's going to Hong Kong, it's going to so many Asian countries that I'm really excited for. It's doing the rounds. So if anyone would like to check out a screening, please check our website. It has all the screening information of where it's being played.
Brilliant. I'm sure we'll link those in the podcast so everyone can access those as well. And it's really exciting to hear that the film is making rounds in Asia as well.
Because we were scared, like, because we have, like, some festivals have, like, not accepted us, and understandably for sort of like legislative issues and societal like viewpoints of queerness and stuff. But it would be really nice for more Asian audiences to experience it in that sense and hopefully find resonance with it, or just
glorious. And in countries where queer representation is, you know, still fighting for at the moment. I mean, obviously we're all fighting, but in other places, and, you know, us being diaspora Asians as well, I think we see, and I speak for myself as well, seeing my friends having to fight for rights that I have been able to enjoy for so many years. You know, it's almost like this is a global struggle.
100%.
And using art as a way to bridge exactly across 100%. Seas.
I'm still hoping that my family in Indonesia get to see it somehow. So,
I mean, I hope that they will and get to revel in the joy because it's stunning. And I suppose this is a really important question in this episode. What is it to be queer and Asian in Britain? Touching upon our privileges of being in Britain and, you know, how we compare to our peers, our family members, our friends, and what the word Asian even means. Because in Asia, the word Asian has much different connotations, that the identities are so much more rooted because they haven't had to collect themselves under one word. How do you both experience the word Asian? It covers such a massive continent. And obviously, across cultures, we share a lot, but we're incredibly different culturally. And within that, how do we experience our queerness? Massive words and impossible to define, despite them being identities that we hold on to. Really big questions to throw you in there. What do you think, Frey?
That's interesting. That is a really big question, yeah. I think for me, the ways that I'm most aware that being queer and Asian come up in my life, beyond the ways that I'm treated differently by the majority of people, I suppose, in, I would say, quite subtle ways, because I am white and Malaysian Chinese, and thus I think the way that I'm treated is very different, for instance, from someone who is like a dark-skinned Southeast Asian, I would say. But I think for me, and especially working in the arts, I'm especially aware of the fact that my being queer and Asian is often seen as kind of enough to cover over the ways that I actually am very, very much similar to the majority of this industry, because I am extraordinarily like educationally privileged and I'm very, very middle class. And sometimes the ways that I'm deferred to because of being queer and Asian, I think, occlude the ways that privileged works. So I think it's good to be as specific as possible about the different ways that we experience things in the world. Mm. That's an answer to your question.
Sure. I would echo a lot of that as well in terms of... So the words queer and Asian only became very much apparent to me when I moved out of Asia into the UK. When you grew up surrounded by Asians and you're considered part of the majority, and then you come to a place where you are considered as a minority and you're sort of seen as the other, that suddenly becomes more pronounced. And then suddenly you realize, oh, I am an Asian and I'm a queer Asian. You're made to see yourself in a more sort of pronounced way because of the ways in which you have to navigate life in Britain. I am still very much, again, privileged in the sense of the access that I've been able to build for myself in terms of like getting work done or being able to sustain myself. But it's also, I'm very aware of how someone like myself can be pigeonholed in terms of what I'm able to offer. So being labeled as a queer Asian, it seems as though I can only cater to queer Asians. Asian is such a big word, and to what Frey said, that I can only sort of speak to my own experiences of being South Asian, of being Indian, of being non-binary, because obviously I can't represent all of the Asian communities, of all the LGBT plus communities. So with those specific intersections of myself, I'm also realizing that people like to pick and choose which aspects of ourselves they'd like to focus on or they seem palatable. So in some spaces, my Asianness is more given a sort of an advantage. In some spaces, my queerness is rather than my Asianness. So sort of finding that balancing act and also reminding not just myself but others that all of these identities coexist and impact the ways in which I live life, and I can't separate either or. And so when we talk about, again, holistic storytelling and bringing our whole selves, if you will, whatever that means, to the kinds of work that we do, I'm always constantly having to remind people that it has to be all of these different things, because people have this tendency, especially those in power, to say like we're too complex, that we're not commercially viable in terms of our stories and the things that we want to put out there because there isn't an audience, we're too niche. But I find that not to be true in terms of how we can still speak a universal language in terms of the kinds of things that we do, but still respect the specificity of our identities. Mm.
I think you've both brought up some really interesting points about honouring specificity, honouring the whole, but on being able to do both at the same time. And so it's a really interesting tug between the two. But I also am really appreciative of the subsidised sector for investing in marginalised community stories, simply because if you don't invest in the audiences, they won't know that the space is safe for them to come into. And I do believe in this era of our artistic community, we are only just waking up to that fact. And it does take a brave act of those in power and those gatekeepers, although I don't believe it to be brave. Like, the numbers speak for themselves. Yeah. The success of these films speaks for itself. And so I'm hoping that more and more gatekeepers and more those in power in that industry and beyond will start to see that. But the struggle to get there is obviously one that we have all experienced in this room. But this question of, you know, who is work for? And how do we spread the word is something that I'm really interested in, because, you know, when I see work and I see this is very specific, it is for this community, but anyone can see the humanity within it. How do we then spread the word of that to invite everyone into seeing this piece or into engaging in this story? And I think that the reviewership has a really big part to play in that. So I'm really interested, Fred, to get your opinion on this, because the state of reviewership in this country is quite an elitist one and incredibly difficult to break into. So I wanted to get your thoughts on how that's been for you.
I mean, I struggle being a reviewer in this country anyway, even though, you know, I've come from pretty much one of the more conventional routes that you can take, I would say. You know, like, I went to Oxford. A lot of the people who review, especially for newspapers in this country, went to Oxford. I started off reviewing for a younger theatre for free. I now only do paid reviews for Exeunt and Stage and What's on Stage. We get paid next to nothing. I'm very happy to name actual numbers, but I think that's actually a really important thing that doesn't get talked about enough. The fact that reviewers It's probably different if you're writing for broadsheet newspapers, but there's no money in reviewing whatsoever. And that means that the people who are doing the reviewing are from largely very middle-class backgrounds. They might be relying on a partner. They certainly have another job. You have very, very little time to write. I have a job 4 days a week currently, and I also do all of my freelancing in terms of dramaturgy and criticism alongside that. Theatre blogging as a thing is basically not really a thing anymore. Those days are kind of past. So what you kind of have now is a limited number of reviewers who are largely, I think, like overwhelmed by the number of things that need reviewing. And again, I'm speaking definitely only to theatre here. Sorry, Shiva. I think there probably are some relevances for film as well. And every year there's a number of like controversies around reviewing in theatre. There are very old dinosaurs who, and also, you know, some young dinosaurs who say some absolutely out of touch, inappropriate, not acceptable things. But I think what's also worth pointing out is that there's a lot of criticism or reviewing, if you want to call it, which is not very interesting. And I don't know the purpose that it's necessarily fulfilling either for the audience or for theatre makers, but also for reviewers. And I don't know that reviewers in this country are necessarily being artistically nourished, whether there's investment from the audience's side or from theatre makers' side in reviewers being encouraged to make good work, which then feeds the ecosystem for everyone. But there's no money. And there's no investment for new talent. There's no roots, really, for reviewers to grow themselves. Anyone wanting to be a theatre reviewer in this country needs to be aware that, like, you're not going to get either clout or money. So you're basically only going to be doing it if you really love it, which is basically the same for going into the arts full stop. So when I see a lot of that animosity between artists and like critics in this country, that's something I really want to point out, that we're basically fighting the same fight, and it's for love of the art itself, because there's nothing else. There's no other reason why any of us would go into this.
I think it's a really careful balance, and one that I'm really interested in listening to a trusted voice, because they are a good writer, for one, because they are a seasoned theatre goer, for two, but also because you have developed a relationship with that publication for their style, their taste, their, you know, whatever it is that resonates with you, versus, you know, an average audience goer whose voice is equally as important, or perhaps comes from that community for which the show is for. And Shiv, I wanted to ask you how you found, I mean, I'm not sure if you want to talk about the reviews of the show, but how you found people's receptions to it. Like, did you find that people's whose lived experience was resonated in the pieces that you made sort of acted more kindly towards it, was an outpour of love? And did you have, this is a bit of a difficult question, I hope you didn't have any reviewers who came to see the work and then didn't get it?
I'm very, very lucky to have overwhelmingly positive feedback, simply because I feel like, A, there is a lack of work like this out there. So there's a natural gravitation towards sort of wanting to consume something like this and experience something like this. So that's definitely a factor. Given that both films speak to a wide spectrum of identities as well. So for example, whether you're watching Peach Paradise, you've got people who are drag queens, you've got people who are burlesque artists, you've got people who are doing a range of things, some who are trans, gender non-conforming, just again, of different identities. And then when you see Queer Parivar, you've got age differences, you've got, again, the gender identities and expression differences. So there are so many different people that can sort of hopefully have a takeaway in that sense of seeing themselves in something. And what's been exciting is to see that even people who aren't Asian have been able to sort of relate to the stories. I was in LA, and after the screening of Queer Parivar over there, this elderly white woman came up to me and was like, I have never seen a lesbian relationship that was joyful at an age like that, at an elderly age where people are just living their lives with such comfort and joy. That wasn't something that she had seen for herself. But on the flip side, I'll point out one review that said the film was Queer Parivar, quote unquote, nothing was happening. And It was interesting in the sense to see, I'm obviously receptive to all kinds of feedback because it's a great way for me to learn and to also just understand the ways in which different people experience it, what their perspectives are, what they're able to take away, because we don't really do much explaining of the people or the identities or the cultural nuances that come in the film. If you get it, you get it in that sense. But this particular person had said that there is nothing going on. And it's interesting because when we see sort of Asian, South Asian stories, especially the ones like Queer Parivar, where you've got that complexity of sort of marriages of convenience, where people back in the day could not speak about their identities publicly, openly, and so caved into weddings that they weren't comfortable with, but had to do it to conform to societal expectations and stuff, but then break out of that at a later stage in life and find themselves, but not just that, but find other people with similar experiences within the family, but perhaps from a different generation. So that all these themes to us as Asians, or at least to me, there's a lot going on there. Yes. There's so much to unpack. I feel like sometimes there's an expectation, especially when it comes to queer films, that there has to be this massive emotional arc that is accentuated, that there needs to be this massive journey that someone needs to go on. And so we're not granted the opportunity to just be and to have things happen, and even if it's the most subtlest of ways, be seen as enough. Mm. And so it's interesting to see how people take different things from it, especially those who aren't from that said community or that said lived experience, how they approach. But I don't know, what's your experience in terms of like just storytelling as a framework? I feel like there can be that very, like the way that it's meant to be, if you will, where people want it to be a certain way, yes, and have a certain arc and sort of like...
That's really interesting, yeah. Mm. It's very... Both of you have said such interesting things so far, and it makes me think about the fact that... And this might sound like me being very contrary, but I feel like it's true. It's so true that we, for a long time, were seeing incredibly traumatic stories about queer life and queer identities. And now I think, and I don't think it's the case with these two films, but that sometimes the hand can like swing too far the other way, and that you only get people talking about wanting to see queer joy. And for instance, like gender euphoria when it comes to trans people and that kind of thing. And I think that can also be simplistic. It doesn't have to be just those two. And I think we do have certain expectations when it comes to seeing queer work. It's interesting. I definitely feel the burden of the job of being like a reviewer more when I'm, for instance, I get sent to review a lot of like, I'm doing air quotes, ethnic shit, like a lot. And that can be like, it can be black, it can be Asian, like different backgrounds that I don't share. But I think that, I get sent to it because, you know, I am biracial. And I also get sent to just queer shit, like a lot. And I have mixed feelings about that. Sometimes I'm glad because it means that, yeah, maybe I can be useful, but it's not the only things that I want to get sent to review. And it's definitely the case that queer people can be more attuned to the certain cliches that come with certain types of queer storytelling. I think that, like, as a dramaturg as well, I definitely am aware that at the moment we talk so much about resisting like Western storytelling structures and that I don't know that we necessarily know how to move the conversation on from that. I think because I want to, and I know so many dramaturgs and writers and directors, white and non-white, whatever, who are, that's what they really want to do. But sometimes the conversation just ends there with a lot of people like earnestly nodding at each other, being like, yes, we must, we must resist it.
Yeah.
But not going on and doing the research on other storytelling structures, for instance, or alternative language that we could be using, or when have we seen something working that was interesting? When did something on paper look like it was going to be perfect for you? Maybe because it was about people who were exactly the same as you, but then you were left kind of cold. And what was it about that that wasn't there.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's a really interesting, because myself, working as a dramaturg, mm. I have been part of some really fascinating and challenging roundtables mm. about what it means to decolonise dramaturgy. Mm. And obviously that is something that's happening in the States as well as in the UK, and the dialogue that's happening between these two countries and our style of dramaturgy, which is rooted in Western storytelling. Yeah. And obviously the driving force behind those conversations are people of the diaspora and in this country. The conversation around decolonising dramaturgy goes to, we know there's a problem,
yep.
let's try and break it. This idea of this gentle storytelling and some someone saying to you, Shiva, that nothing really happens. Mm. And from your experience, you're feeling, well, lots of things have happened. So much has been unpacked. And I always think of, as an East Asian person, I think of Japanese storytelling and how gentle and not always, but there is a leaning into that storytelling that is simply about being, and famously the tale of Princess Kaguya being one of the most nothing happening animations that exist, but that is the point.
Yeah.
The point is to breathe, the point yes. is to exist. And in this modern day and age where we are so overstimulated, how do we, there are so many things to break out of there. If you'll allow me to pull some of the threads that we've already talked about together, it's this idea of being a maker of a marginalized community, being Asian, whatever that means to you, the pressure to represent your entire community, whether it is as a reviewer or a maker, being like, well, I am one of the very few people that has the lived experience to review this properly, or I'm one of the very few makers that can tell these stories properly. It's such a struggle to cover the vastness of that experience that you will have people of the diaspora who are just learning about their experience, just learning about how to decolonize themselves, and others who are at the very forefront of progression and politics and fighting for, you know, policy and our rights. And in a way, being able to connect these vast experiences in just a few works or just in a few words is an almost impossible task. But it is something that, if you are one of very few artists or few reviewers, you are faced with an absolutely impossible task. And how do we ease that from each other? What are the routes in? What do we need to do? What do we need to encourage our industry to take the next step into so that this pressure is not on just us individuals?
Sure.
I just asked some huge questions. No,
very apologies. Heavy question. No, it's a good one though, in terms of like, yes. Okay. So I keep saying this, and a lot of people have referred to sort of like the work that I do and stuff, representing the LGBT plus South Asian community and stuff. And I'm like, no, not really. I can only represent myself and my experiences, my lived experiences, and bring that to the table. For me to go beyond that, I need to bring other people with their experiences. And that's what's been beautiful about these two films that I've been able to be part of, is that we've been able to bring other people to the table, open the door so that they can come in and share their experiences and be part of that storytelling process. So that's not just my voice, and that we're having that collective contribution, so that we have very specific nuances that can be reflected back to an audience. And so it's never just me. And I need to keep reminding myself that I can't speak for everyone. Mm-hmm. And the work that needs to be done is that we can't expect that as well from everyone. And so we need to work on, again, the structure of the industry as a whole, in terms of how can we bring more voices? Because again, it's that danger of that one singular voice or the few that are there out there. We need more stories. We need more creators. And unfortunately, it's down to us also to bring more people with us. Mm-hmm. And that's what if you have the opportunity and the ability to do that, then why not? I think with QP, Queer Parivar, we're very fortunate to create 120 plus jobs mm-hmm. for that film, in terms of like bringing a largely queer sort of crew on screen, off screen, where everyone can feel like they can have an input into the process in whichever way. And so a lot of the script and the story, while yes, there was a framework and there was a blueprint, there was a template, but there was enough room for people to play with it. So if the set designer wanted to come and say, how about doing it this way? Because like, this could be nice in their perspective. Yes, run with it. Let's all bring our collective sort of experiences to this so that everyone can feel like there's that ownership, co-ownership of that project or that piece that we're working towards. Mm. So I think that was sort of the mindset that we went into the films with as well. So yes, I feel like there is pressure in terms of like the few people who are creating work, and also this expectation that we can't make mistakes, that we can't grow and evolve. And unfortunately, if we aren't met with that, or if we don't meet that expectation of society, that we have in some way failed. And so I feel like there needs to be more empathy and room for us to grow collectively and make room for others to also feed into that, so that we can actually grow, do more work and bring more people on. Because otherwise we're just stunted there and being stereotyped as something that is lesser than the potential and capability that we have.
And I think that there is something there about what we're talking about being queer and Asian, that these two communities share, that we're very good at liberating ourselves from mainstream shackles, whatever that may be, and also to uplift each other as communities. I find that often the lessons I learn about myself and my self-care is stuff that I've taken from my queer peers, that then actually that feeds into the community work I do with the East Asian and Southeast Asian community. And the sharing of that liberty is something that has felt really powerful. I'm interested into it as to how we also bring that to reviewership, Frey, because when I see work, I'll bring up an incredible show called Tokyo Rose, which I thought was just magnificently done. I mean, the craft of every department, the skill and the talent in that show was overwhelming. And for an audience, or majority East Asian, I was so glad to see so many East Asian faces in the audience telling a Japanese story of Eva Togura. That diaspora story, it's the perfect audience to do it in for a London audience. I was so upset to see that the reviewers just didn't get it. And I think if you come from that community, if you understand the conflict between being brought up in a Western culture and from an East Asian heritage, if you don't appreciate that conflict, then the show just didn't make sense to a lot of the reviewers. And it was such a shame to see that, because I felt that show had so much life to give. And you know, who knows what's happening with it now, but I see that being repeated again and again with work that has been made by people of global majority and it being not recognised and therefore not having the springboard to then enter into mainstream spaces.
I think that we definitely do need funds and programmes to nurture new reviewing talent. And what would help with that is like an investment, an artistic investment by artists as well as audiences and critics in seeing criticism nurtured. It's difficult. I don't think that the answer is as simple as, for instance, the only reviewers who share the same like racial background or class background as the subjects of like a piece of art should have to review that, because ultimately that's just going to constrain people more, I think. But the way that you responded to like my simple comment about like the use of sound in queer parivar makes me think about the fact that it's very rare that you get critics sat down with artists where it's not an interview. I have learned that I'm not good with doing interviews as a writer. No. I mean, like as a interviewer, I'm no good, I think. I would much rather talk about the art itself. So the fact that you responded so positively to that simple comment of mine, and that I then found out so much more about your thought process behind the choices to do with sound in your film, that's so interesting and so nourishing to me. And it makes me think about the fact that the relationship between critic and artist is often so antagonistic, and that if there were more opportunities for dialogue to happen, that would be great, basically, and probably would lead to a better understanding between the two roles.
Yes, I absolutely agree. It's really interesting, the description of the relationship between artist and critic as antagonistic. And I think that actually that is something that is very present in a lot of the artistic community, that this antagonistic behaviour that I often experience. And if I read a review or if I read a critique about a show, I sometimes find myself screaming at the page like, this isn't for you. you have no idea what you're talking about. But that is my experience, because we've already talked about dramaturgy and us going around in circles of, we know we need to decolonize dramaturgy, but we don't know how. And I think this is the very beginning of those conversations of how we move forward from that. But I'm hoping that more of these conversations and actually more empathy between the roles, between audiences and critics and artists will just help that. Because if you understand why an artist is doing something, like understanding the sound choices that Shiv has made, suddenly your experience of those choices becomes much more emotionally connected and therefore empathetic. And what is the point of art if not to grow empathy? And so I really believe that those connections can make a big difference to furthering the conversation. This concept of decolonizing our work and also removing the heteronormative shackles that we experience in making art, I want to give us permission, both to us at the table here and to our listeners, to free ourselves of form. Because we've talked about Western storytelling and we've talked about what is happening and what kind of stories, whether it be trauma or joy in queer stories, to free ourselves of needing to either educate or to commit to a structure that we have been taught, that actually the way to move forwards is to create our own. And it may be that what you create is unpalatable, but it will be inspiring to one other person, and that other person will create something that will inspire someone else. And this domino effect of inspiration is what I hope to leave this podcast with and with our listeners, that it will be a collective effort of uplifting each other and inspiring each other, and there will be a lot of mistakes. And until we flood the landscape with our stories, we won't find that balance that we're looking for. We are allowed to break form and create our own stories for ourselves. Thank you so much for listening. I hope that you have enjoyed this podcast. I'm very excited to hear the rest of it, and I'm going to hand you back to 2A. I've been May Mack. Thank you very much.
I feel like we need to do a round of applause or something. Oh my gosh, I don't actually know what to say. I don't want to conclude it. My heart is just filled. I mean, just the nuances of this conversation and the joy that's generated in this room right now. I don't want it to end, but it has to. But the good news is, even though this one has ended, we do have another one coming out next week. And the topic of discussion is the absence of North African voices in Britain. So on that note, thank you so much, Frey, May and Shiva. You guys have been such a joy to listen to. And thank you for being.
Thank you.
For Thank being. You so much. I love that. Yeah. For being. If I had a glass of wine in my hand, I would cheers you all on for being.
Let's just do it. For being. Clink, clink.
Clink.
Wow. Do you know what? I feel like I'm saying wow in everyone.
Wow.
Wow.
And avocado.
Oh my God. Wow. Tell them.